Truck Audio Tales.
Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers make a roaring sound every 3 steps. Made with green scaly fabric, soft plush uppers, foam footbeds, non-slip grips on soles, and 3 white claws on each foot. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 9. Footbed measures 10.5. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter of a novel or a whole short story. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, and cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us for our monthly show about the Cthulhu mythos. Look for our podcast near the old wishing well in the blasted heath, wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean or Apple Podcasts. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and at Black Clock Audio on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Welcome to Black Clock Audio Tales. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. The Chamber, Oppressive Gloom, Despair. Welcome to Part 1, Folklore of Great Britain.
Join us at the end of the month when we talk about the Great Old Ones.
Canonbe Dick and Thomas of Ercildoun. It chanced long years ago that a certain horse dealer lived in the south of Scotland near the border, not very far from Longtown. He was known as Canonbe Dick, and as he went up and down the country, he almost always had a long string of horses behind him, which he bought at one fair and sold at another, generally managing to turn a good big penny by the transaction. He was a very fearless man, not easily daunted, and the people who knew him used to say that if Canonbe Dick dare not attempt a thing, no one else need be asked to do it. One evening, as he was returning from a fair at some distance from his home, with a pair of horses which he had not succeeded in selling, he was riding over Bowden Moor, which lies to the west of the Eildon Hills. These hills are, as all men know, the scene of some of the most famous of Thomas the Rhymer's prophecies, and also, as men say, they are the sleeping place of King Arthur and his knights, who rest under the 3 high peaks, waiting for the mystic call that shall awake them. But little recked the horse-dealer of Arthur and his knights, nor yet of Thomas the Rhymer. He was riding along at a snail's pace, thinking over the bargains which he had made at the fair that day, and wondering when he was likely to dispose of his 2 remaining horses. All at once he was startled by the approach of a venerable man with white hair and an old-world dress, who seemed almost to start out of the ground, so suddenly did he make his appearance. When they met, the stranger stopped, and to Canonbe Dick's great amazement, asked him for how much he would be willing to part with his horses. The wily horse-dealer thought that he saw a chance of driving a good bargain, for the stranger looked a man of some consequence, so he named a good round sum. The old man tried to bargain with him, but when he found that he had not much chance of succeeding, for no one ever did succeed in inducing Canonbe Dick to sell a horse for a less sum than he named for it at first, he agreed to buy the animals, and pulling a bag of gold from the pocket of his queerly cut breeches, he began to count out the price. As he did so, Canonbe Dick got another shock of surprise, for the gold that the stranger gave him was not the gold that was in use at the time, but was fashioned into unicorns and bonnet pieces and other ancient coins, which would be of no use to the horse-dealer in his everyday transactions. But it was good pure gold, and he took it gladly, for he knew that he was selling his horses at about half as much again as they were worth. So, thought he to himself, surely I cannot be the loser in the long run. Then the 2 departed, but not before the old man had commissioned Dick to get him other good horses at the same price, the only stipulation he made being that Dick should always bring them to the same spot after dark, and that he should always come alone. And as time went on, the horse dealer found that he had indeed met a good customer. For whenever he came across a suitable horse, he had only to lead it over Bowden Moor after dark, and he was sure to meet the mysterious white-headed stranger, who always paid him for the animal in old-fashioned golden pieces. And he might have been selling horses to him yet, for aught I know, had it not been for his one failing. Canonby Dick was apt to get very thirsty, and his ordinary customers, knowing this, took care always to provide him with something to drink. The old man never did so. He paid down his money and led away his horses, and there was an end of the matter. But one night, Dick, being even more thirsty than usual, and feeling sure that his mysterious friend must live somewhere in the neighborhood, seeing that he was always wandering about the hillside when everyone else was asleep, hinted that he would be very glad to go home with him and have a little refreshment. "He would need to be a brave man who asks to go home with me," returned the stranger. "But if thou wilt, thou canst follow me. Only remember this. If thy courage fail thee at that which thou wilt behold, thou wilt rue it all thy life." Canonby Dick laughed long and loud. "My courage hath never failed me yet," he cried. "Beshrew me if I will let it fail now. So lead on, old man, and I will follow." Without a word, the stranger turned and began to ascend a narrow path, which led to a curious hillock, which from its shape was called by the country folk the Lucken Hare. It was supposed to be a great haunt of witches, and as a rule nobody passed that way after dark, if they could possibly help it. Canonby Dick was not afraid of witches, however, so he followed his guide with a bold step up the hillside. But it must be confessed that he felt a little startled when he saw him turn down what seemed to be an entrance to a cavern, especially as he never remembered having seen any opening in the hillside there before. He paused for a moment, looking round him in perplexity, wondering where he was being taken, and his conductor glanced at him scornfully. "You can go back if you will," he said. "I'll warn thee thou wert going on a journey that would try thy courage to the utmost." There was a jeering note in his voice that touched Dick's pride. "Who said that I was afraid?" he retorted. "I was just taking note of where this passage stands on the hillside, so as to know it another time." The stranger shrugged his shoulders. "Time enough to look for it when thou wouldst visit it again," he said, and then he pursued his way, with Dick following closely at his heels. After the first yard or two they were enveloped in thick darkness, and the horse-dealer would have been sore put to keep near his guide had not the latter held out his hand for him to grasp. But after a little space a faint glimmering of light began to appear, which grew clearer and clearer, until at last they found themselves in an enormous cavern lit by flaming torches, which were stuck here and there in sconces in the rocky walls, and which, although they served to give light enough to see by, yet threw such ghostly shadows on the floor that they only seemed to intensify the gloom that hung over the vast apartment. And the curious thing about this mysterious cave was that along one side of it ran a long row of horse stalls, just like one would find in a stable, and in each stall stood a coal-black charger, saddled and bridled as if ready for the fray, and on the straw by every horse's side lay the gallant figure of a knight, clad from head to foot in coal-black armor, with a drawn sword in his mailed hand. But not a horse moved, not a chain rattled. Knights and steeds alike were silent and motionless, looking exactly as if some strange enchantment had been thrown over them, and they had been suddenly turned into black marble. There was something so awesome in the still cold figures, and in the unearthly silence that brooded over everything, that Canonby Dick, reckless and daring though he was, felt his courage waning and his knees beginning to shake under him. In spite of these feelings, however, he followed the old man up the hall to the far end of it, where there was a table of ancient workmanship, on which was placed a glittering sword, and a curiously wrought hunting horn. When they reached this table, the stranger turned to him and said, with great dignity, "Thou hast heard, good man, of Thomas of Erceldoune, Thomas the Rhymer, as men call him, he who went to dwell for a time with the Queen of Fairyland, and from her received the gifts of truth and prophecy?" Canonby Dick nodded, for as the wonderful soothsayer's name fell on his ears, his heart sank within him, and his tongue seemed to cleave to the roof of his mouth. If he had been brought there to parley with Thomas the Rhymer, then he had laid himself open to all the eldritch powers of darkness. "I that speak to thee am he," went on the white-haired stranger, "and I have permitted thee thus to have thy desire, and follow me hither in order that I may try of what stuff thou art made. Before thee lies a horn and a sword. He that will sound the one or draw the other shall, if his courage fail not, be king over the whole of Britain. I, Thomas the Rhymer, have spoken it, and as thou knowest, my tongue cannot lie. But list thee, the outcome of it all depends on thy bravery, and it will be a light task or a heavy, according as thou layest hand on sword or horn first." Now Dick was more versed in giving blows than in making music, and his first impulse was to seize the sword. Then, come what might, he had something in his hand to defend himself with. But just as he was about to lift it, the thought struck him that if the place were full of spirits, as he felt sure that it must be, this action of him might be taken to mean defiance, and might cause them to band themselves together against him. So, changing his mind, he picked up the horn with a trembling hand, and blew a blast upon it, which, however, was so weak and feeble that it could scarce be heard at the other end of the hall. The result that followed was enough to appall the stoutest heart. Thunder rolled in, crashing peals through the immense hall. The charmed knights and their horses woke in an instant from their enchanted sleep. The knights sprang to their feet and seized their swords, brandishing them round their heads, while their great black chargers stamped and snorted and ground their bits as if eager to escape from their stalls. And where a moment before all had been stillness and silence, there was now a scene of wild din and excitement. Now was the time for Canonby Dick to play the man. If he had done so, all the rest of his life might have been different. But his courage failed him, and he lost his chance. Terrified at seeing so many threatening faces turned towards him, he dropped the horn and made one weak, undecided effort to pick up the sword. But, ere he could do so, a mysterious voice sounded from somewhere in the hall, and these were the words that it uttered. "Woe to the coward that ever he was born, who did not draw the sword before he blew the horn." And before Dick knew what he was about, a perfect whirlwind of cold, raw air tore through the cavern, carrying the luckless horse-dealer along with it, and hurrying him along the narrow passage through which he had entered, dashing him down outside on a bank of loose stones and shale. He fell right to the bottom, and was found, with little life left in him, next morning by some shepherds, to whom he had just strength enough left to whisper the story of his weird and fearful adventure. The Laird o' Coe. It was a fine summer morning, and the Laird o' Coe was having a dander on the green turf outside the castle walls. His real name was the Laird o' Coleszine, and his descendants today bear the proud title of Marquises of Ailsa. But all up and down Ayrshire nobody called him anything else than the Laird o' Coe, because of the coes, or caves, which were to be found in the rock on which his castle was built. He was a kind man, and a courteous, always ready to be interested in the affairs of his poorest neighbors, and willing to listen to any tale of woe. So when a little boy came across the green, carrying a small can in his hand, and, pulling his forelock, asking him if he might go to the castle and get a little ale for his sick mother, The laird gave his consent at once, and patting the little fellow on the head, told him to go to the kitchen and ask for the butler, and tell him that he, the laird, had given orders that his can was to be filled with the best ale that was in the cellar. Away the boy went and found the old butler, who, after listening to his message, took him down into the cellar and proceeded to carry out his master's orders. There was one cask of particularly fine ale, which was kept entirely for the laird's own use, which had been opened some time before, and which was now about half full. "I will fill the bairn's can out of this," thought the old man to himself. "'Tis both nourishing and light, the very thing for sick folk." So taking the can from the child's hand, he proceeded to draw the ale. But what was his astonishment to find that although the ale flowed freely enough from the barrel, the little can, which could not have held more than a quarter of a gallon, remained always just half full. The ale poured into it in a clear amber stream until the big cask was quite empty, and still the quantity that was in the little can did not seem to increase. The butler could not understand it. He looked at the cask, and then he looked at the can. Then he looked down at the floor at his feet to see if he had not spilt any. No, the ale had not disappeared in that way, for the cellar floor was as white and dry and clean as possible. "Plague on the can, it must be bewitched," thought the old man, and his short stubby hair stood up like porcupine quills round his bald head, for if there was anything on earth of which he had a mortal dread, it was warlocks and witches and such like bogles. "I'm not going to broach another barrel," he said gruffly, handing back the half-filled can to the little lad, "so ye may just go home with what is there. The laird's ale is too good to waste on a smatchet like thee." But the boy stoutly held his ground. A promise was a promise, and the laird had both promised and sent orders to the butler that the can was to be filled, and he would not go home till it was filled. It was in vain that the old man first argued, and then grew angry. The boy would not stir a step. The laird had said that he was to get the ale, and the ale he must have. At last the perturbed butler left him standing there, and hurried off to his master, to tell him he was convinced that the can was bewitched, for it had swallowed up a whole half cask of ale, and after doing so it was only half full, and to ask if he would come down himself and order the lad off the premises. "Not I," said the genial laird, "for the little fellow is quite right. I promised that he should have his can full of ale to take home to his sick mother, and he shall have it if it takes all the barrels in my cellar to fill it. So haste thee to the house again, and open another cask." The butler dare not disobey, so he reluctantly retraced his steps. But as he went, he shook his head sadly, for it seemed to him that not only the boy with the can, but his master also was bewitched. When he reached the cellar, he found the bairn waiting patiently where he had left him, and without wasting further words, he took the can from his hand and broached another barrel. If he had been astonished before, he was more astonished now. Scarce had a couple of drops fallen from the tap, than the can was full to the brim. "Take it, laddie, and begone with all the speed thou canst," he said, glad to get the can out of his fingers. And the boy did not wait for a second bidding, thanking the butler most earnestly for his trouble, and paying no attention to the fact that the old man had not been so civil to him as he might have been, he departed. Nor, though the butler took pains to ask all round the countryside, could he ever hear of him again, nor of anyone who knew anything about him, or anything about his sick mother. Years passed by, and sore trouble fell upon the house of Co, for the laird went to fight in the wars in Flanders, and chancing to be taken prisoner, he was shut up in prison and condemned to death. Alone in a foreign country, he had no friends to speak for him, and escape seemed hopeless. It was the night before his execution, and he was sitting in his lonely cell, thinking sadly of his wife and children, whom he never expected to see again. At the thought of them, the picture of his home rose clearly in his mind. The grand old castle standing on its rock, and the bonny daisy-spangled stretch of greensward, which lay before its gates, where he had been wont to take a dander in the sweet summer mornings. Then, all unbidden, a vision of the little lad carrying the can, who had come to beg ale for his sick mother, and whom he had long ago forgotten, rose up before him. The vision was so clear and distinct that he felt almost as if he were acting the scene over again, and he rubbed his eyes to get rid of it, feeling that, if he had to die tomorrow, it was time that he turned his thoughts to better things. But as he did so, the door of his cell flew noiselessly open, and there, on the threshold, stood the self-same little lad, looking not a day older, with his finger on his lip and a mysterious smile upon his face. "Laird o' Co, rise and go," he whispered, beckoning to him to follow him. Needless to say, the laird did so, too much amazed to think of asking questions. Through the long passages of the prison the little lad went, the laird close at his heels, and whenever he came to a locked door he had but to touch it, and it opened before them, so that in no long time they were safe outside the walls. The overjoyed laird would have overwhelmed his little deliverer with words of thanks, had not the boy held up his hand to stop him. "Get on my back," he said shortly, "for thou art not safe till thou art out of this country." The laird did as he was bid, and marvelous as it seems, the boy was quite able to bear his weight. As soon as he was comfortably seated, the pair set off over sea and land, and never stopped till, in almost less time than it takes to tell it, the boy set him down in the early dawn on the daisy-spangled green in front of his castle, just where he had spoken first to him so many years before. Then he turned and laid his little hand on the laird's big one. "Ay, good turn deserves anither. Take ye that for being so kind to my old mither," he said, and vanished. And from that day to this, he has never been seen again. Home. Pussy Bawdrins. "Pussy, Pussy Bawdrins, where hae ye been? I'd been at London seeing the Queen." "Pussy, Pussy Bawdrins, what got ye there?" "I got a good fat mousikie grinning up a stair." "Pussy, Pussy Bawdrins, what did ye do it?" "I put it in my meal poke to eat it to my bread."
The Milk-White Dew. There was once a man who got his living by working in the fields. He had one little son called Curly Locks, and one little daughter called Golden Tresses, but his wife was dead, and, as he had to be out all day, these children were often left alone. So, as he was afraid that some evil might befall them, when there was no one to look after them, he, in an ill day, married again. I say, in an ill day, for his second wife was a most deceitful woman who really hated children, although she pretended before her marriage to love them. And she was so unkind to them and made the house so uncomfortable with her bad temper that her poor husband often sighed to himself and wished that he had let well alone and remained a widower. But it was no use crying over spilt milk. The deed was done, and he had just to try to make the best of it. So things went on for several years, until the children were beginning to run about the doors and play by themselves. Then one day the good man chanced to catch a hare, and he brought it home and gave it to his wife to cook for the dinner. Now his wife was a very good cook, and she made the hare into a pot of delicious soup. But she was also very greedy, and while the soup was boiling, she tasted it and tasted it, till at last she discovered that it was almost gone. Then she was in a fine state of mind, for she knew that her husband would soon be coming home for his dinner, and that she would have nothing to set before him. So what do you think the wicked woman did? She went out to the door, where her little stepson, Curly Locks, was playing in the sun, and told him to come in and get his face washed. And while she was washing his face, She struck him on the head with a hammer and stunned him, and popped him into the pot to make soup for his father's dinner. By and by the good man came in from his work, and the soup was dished up, and he and his wife and his little daughter, Golden Tresses, sat down to sup it. "Where's Curly Locks?" asked the good man. "It's a pity he is not here as long as the soup is hot." "How should I ken?" answered his wife crossly. "I have other work to do than to run about after a mischievous laddie all the morning." The good man went on supping his soup in silence for some minutes. Then he lifted up a little foot in his spoon. "This is Curly Locks's foot," he cried in horror. "There hath been ill work here." "Hoots, havers," answered his wife, laughing, pretending to be very much amused. "What should Curly Locks's foot be doing in the soup? 'Tis the hare's forefoot, which is very like that of a bairn." But presently the good man took something else up in his spoon. "This is Curly Locks's hand," he said shrilly. "I ken it by the crook in its little finger." "The man's demented," retorted his wife, "not to ken the hind foot of a hare when he sees it." So the poor father did not say any more, but went away out to his work, sorely perplexed in his mind, while his little daughter, Golden Tresses, who had a shrewd suspicion of what had happened, gathered all the bones from the empty plates, and, carrying them away in her apron, buried them beneath a flat stone, close by a white rose tree that grew by the cottage door. And lo and behold, those poor bones which she buried with such care grew and grew to a milk-white dew that took its wings and away it flew. And at last it lighted on a tuft of grass by a burnside where two women were washing clothes. It sat there cooing to itself for some time. Then it sang this song softly to them. "Pew, pew, my mimmy me slew, my daddy me chew, my sister gathered my bains and put them between two milk-white stains, and I grew and grew to a milk-white dew, and I took to my wings, and away I flew." The women stopped washing and looked at one another in astonishment. It was not every day that they came across a bird that could sing a song like that, and they felt that there was something not canny about it. "Sing that song again, my bonny bird," said one of them at last. "I will give thee all these clothes." So the bird sang its song over again, and the washerwomen gave it all the clothes, and it tucked them under its right wing and flew on. Presently it came to a house where all the windows were open, and it perched on one of the window-sills, and inside it saw a man counting out a great heap of silver, and sitting on the window-sill it sang its song to him. "Pew, pew, my mimmy me slew, my daddy me chew, my sister gathered my bains and put them between two milk-white stains, and I grew and grew to a milk-white dew, and I took to my wings and away I flew." The man stopped counting his silver and listened. He felt, like the washerwomen, that there was something not canny about this dew. When it had finished its song, he said, "Sing that song again, my bonny bird, and I'll give thee all this siller in a bag." So the dew sang its song over again, and got the bag of silver which it tucked under its left wing. Then it flew on. It had not flown very far, however, before it came to a mill, where two millers were grinding corn, and it settled down on a sack of meal and sang its song to them. "Pew, pew, my mimmy me slew, my daddy me chew, my sister gathered my bains and put them between two milk-white stains, and I grew and grew to a milk-white dew, and I took to my wings, and away I flew." The millers stopped their work and looked at one another, scratching their heads in amazement. "Sing that song over again, my bonny bird," exclaimed both of them together, when the dew had finished, "and we will give thee this millstone." So the dew repeated its song and got the millstone, which it asked one of the millers to lift on its back. Then it flew out of the mill and up the valley, leaving the two men staring after it, dumb with astonishment. As you may think, the milk-white dew had a heavy load to carry, but it went bravely on till it came within sight of its father's cottage, and lighted down at last on the thatched roof. Then it laid its burdens on the thatch, and flying down to the courtyard picked up a number of little chucky stones. With them in its beak it flew back to the roof, and began to throw them down the chimney. By this time it was evening, and the good man and his wife and his little daughter, Golden Tresses, were sitting round the table eating their supper, and you may be sure that they were all very much startled when the stones came rattling down the chimney, bringing such a cloud of soot with them that they were like to be smothered. They all jumped up from their chairs and ran outside to see what the matter was. And Golden Tresses, being the littlest, ran the fastest, and when she came out at the door, the milk-white dew flung the bundle of clothes down at her feet. And the father came out next, and the milk-white dew flung the bag of silver down at his feet. But the wicked stepmother, being somewhat stout, came out last. And the milk-white dew threw the millstone right down on her head and killed her. Then it spread its wings and flew away, and has never been seen again. But it had made the good man and his daughter rich for life, and it had rid them of the cruel stepmother, so that they lived in peace and plenty. The Driglin Hogni. There was once a man who had three sons, and very little money to provide for them. So, when the eldest had grown into a lad, and saw that there was no means of making a livelihood at home, he went to his father and said to him, "Father, if thou wilt give me a horse to ride on, a hound to hunt with, and a hawk to fly, I will go out into the wide world and seek my fortune." His father gave him what he asked for, and he set out on his travels. He rode and he rode over mountain and glen, until, just at nightfall, he came to a thick, dark wood. He entered it, thinking that he might find a path that would lead him through it, but no path was visible, and after wandering up and down for some time, he was obliged to acknowledge to himself that he was completely lost. There seemed to be nothing for it but to tie his horse to a tree and make a bed of leaves for himself on the ground, but just as he was about to do so, he saw a light glimmering in the distance, and riding on in the direction in which it was, he soon came to a clearing in the wood, in which stood a magnificent castle. The windows were all lit up, but the great door was barred, and after he had ridden up to it and knocked and received no answer, the young man raised his hunting horn to his lips and blew a loud blast in the hope of letting the inmates know that he was without. Instantly the door flew open of its own accord, and the young man entered, wondering very much what this strange thing would mean. And he wondered still more when he passed from room to room, and found that, although fires were burning brightly everywhere, and there was a plentiful meal laid out on the table in the great hall, there did not seem to be a single person in the whole of the vast building. However, as he was cold and tired and wet, he put his horse in one of the stalls of the enormous stable, and taking his hawk and hound along with him, went into the hall and ate a hearty supper, after which he sat down by the side of the fire and began to dry his clothes. By this time it had grown late, and he was just thinking of retiring to one of the bedrooms which he had seen upstairs and going to bed, when a clock which was hanging on the wall struck 12. Instantly the door of the huge apartment opened, and a most awful-looking Draiglin Hogni entered. His hair was matted, and his beard was long, and his eyes shone like stars of fire from under his bushy eyebrows, and in his hands he carried a queerly shaped club. He did not seem at all astonished to see his unbidden guest, but, coming across the hall, he sat down upon the opposite side of the fireplace, and resting his chin on his hands, gazed fixedly at him. "Doth thy horse ever kick any?" he said at last, in a harsh, rough voice. "Ay, doth he," replied the young man, for the only steed that his father had been able to give him was a wild and unbroken colt. "I have some skill in taming horses," went on the Draiglin Hogni, "and I will give thee something to tame thine withal. Throw this over him," and he pulled one of the long, coarse hairs out of his head and gave it to the young man. And there was something so commanding in the Hogni's voice that he did as he was bid, and went out to the stable and threw the hair over the horse. Then he returned to the hall and sat down again by the fire. The moment that he was seated, the Draiglin Hogni asked another question. "Doth thy hound ever bite any?" "Aye, verily," answered the youth, for his hound was so fierce-tempered that no man save his master dare lay a hand on him. "'I can cure the wildest-tempered dog in Christendom,' replied the Draiglin Hogni. "'Take that and throw it over him.' And he pulled another hair out of his head and gave it to the young man, who lost no time in flinging it over his hound. There was still a third question to follow. "'Doth ever thy hawk peck any?' The young man laughed. "'I have ever to keep a bandage over her eyes, save when she is ready to fly,' said he. "'Else were nothing safe within her reach.' "'Things will be safe now,' said the Hogni, grimly. "'Throw that over her.' And for the third time he pulled a hair from his head and handed it to his companion. And as the other hairs had been thrown over the horse and the hound, so this one was thrown over the hawk. Then, before the young man could draw breath, the fearsome Draiglin Hogni had given him such a clout on the side of his head with his queer-shaped club that he fell down in a heap on the floor. And very soon his hawk and his hound tumbled down still and motionless beside him, and out in the stable his horse became stark and stiff, as if turned to stone. For the Draiglin's words had meant more than at first appeared when he said that he could make all unruly animals quiet. Sometime afterwards the second of the three sons came to his father in the old home with the same request that his brother had made, that he should be provided with a horse and a hawk and a hound, and be allowed to go out to seek his fortune, and his father listened to him and gave him what he asked, as he had given his brother. And the young man set out, and in due time came to the wood, and lost himself in it, just as his brother had done. Then he saw the light, and came to the castle, and went in, and had supper, and dried his clothes, just as it had all happened before. And the Draiglin Hogni came in, and asked him the three questions, and he gave the same three answers, and received three hairs, one to throw over his horse, one to throw over his hound, and one to throw over his hawk. Then the Hogni killed him, just as he had killed his brother. Time passed, and the youngest son, finding that his two elder brothers never returned, asked his father for a horse, a hawk, and a hound, in order that he might go and look for them. And the poor old man, who was feeling very desolate in his old age, gladly gave them to him. So he set out on his quest, and at nightfall he came, as the others had done, to the thick wood and the castle. But, being a wise and cautious youth, he liked not the way in which he found things. He liked not the empty house. He liked not the spread-out feast, and most of all, he liked not the look of the Draiglin Hogni when he saw him. And he determined to be very careful what he said or did, as long as he was in his company. So when the Draiglin Hogni asked him if his horse kicked, he replied that it did in very few words, and when he got one of the Hogni's hares to throw over him, he went out to the stable and pretended to do so, but he brought it back hidden in his hand, and when his unchancy companion was not looking, he threw it into the fire. It fizzled up like a tongue of flame with a little hissing sound, like that of a serpent. "'What's that fizzlin?' asked the giant suspiciously. "'Tis but the sap of the green wood,' replied the young man, carelessly, as he turned to caress his hound. The answer satisfied the Draiglin Hogni, and he paid no heed to the sound which the hare that should have been thrown over the hound, or the sound which the hare that should have been thrown over the hawk, made. When the young man threw them into the fire, and they fizzled up in the same way that the first had done. Then, thinking that he had the stranger in his power, he whisked across the hearthstone to strike him with his club, as he had struck his brothers. But the young man was on the lookout, and when he saw them coming, he gave a shrill whistle, and his horse, which loved him dearly, came galloping in from the stable, and his hound sprang up from the hearthstone where he had been sleeping, and his hawk, who was sitting on his shoulder, ruffled up her feathers and screamed harshly, and they all fell on the Draiglin Hogni at once, and he found out only too well how the horse kicked, and the hound bit, and the hawk pecked, for they kicked him and bit him and pecked him till he was as dead as a doornail. When the young man saw that he was dead, he took his little club from his hand, and armed with that he set out to explore the castle. As he expected, he found that there were dark and dreary dungeons under it, and in one of them he found his two brothers lying cold and stiff side by side. He touched them with the club, and instantly they came to life again and sprang to their feet as well as ever. Then he went into another dungeon, and there were the two horses and the two hawks and the two hounds, lying as if dead, exactly as their masters had lain. He touched them with his magic club, and they too came to life again. Then he called to his two brothers, and the three young men searched the other dungeons, and they found great stores of gold and silver hidden in them, enough to make them rich for life. So they buried the Draeglen Hogni and took possession of the castle, and two of them went home and brought their old father back with them, and they all were as prosperous and happy as they could be. And, for aught that I know, they are living there still.